Good evening. You're either watching or listening to Redwood Wonk. I'm with David Frank. My name is Eric Kirk. We are discussing national news of the day. And for the first segment, we're actually going to go across the Pacific Ocean and discuss some very disturbing events that so far ended well in South Korea. And we will discuss their implications for American politics. And that basically, the president, I won't say out of the blue, there were things that were leading up to it. The president had been elected, a very conservative guy, to replace a progressive. The presidential terms, everybody gets one term for 5 years. The progressive guy, his term expired. Very close election, and a conservative former prosecutor who was really big on South Korea's versions of possibly deep state theories was elected. Well, his first 2 years really didn't go well, according to the voters, and so the opposition parties took the majority in the what would be considered, I guess, kind of similar to their midterm election. And then he wasn't able to do anything. And so he declared martial law just the other night, in the middle of the night, and ordered that the police shut down the assembly, and the military and the police shut down the assembly, and that he shut down the press. Neither of those things really happened. The military and a number of police showed up at the assembly. But a quorum of assembly members rushed there from their homes. It was, again, after hours, and in order to vote to shut down martial law. I'm not exactly sure how martial law works in South Korea, or whether or not the president there had the constitutional authority to declare it. And if so, or even if not, did the assembly have the constitutional authority to override it? The police, the captains that were on the scene, as protests were erupting, they were on the phone with their captains asking what to do. Military had declared that they were going to abide by the martial law. And then after the assembly took its vote, they just weren't doing anything and they weren't taking phone calls. And so this led to a standoff, huge protests. The president eventually backed off and revoked the martial law. So a good ending to a very, assuming it's over, to a very disturbing sequence of events. And so we're going to discuss that a little bit of the history, just because it's fascinating whether or not martial law can be declared here. And the law is a little tricky about that. It's ambiguous. And in fact, martial law has been declared here during the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln did. There was martial law in New Orleans in 1812. States have declared it during strikes and other emergencies. One of the southern states had a segregationist governor that declared martial law to be able to arbitrarily arrest freedom riders, for who were protesting segregation that had already been deemed illegal. And so, and what martial law really does is it gives the executive power to basically deny individual rights, to deny habeas corpus, or to basically be able to arrest people without due process. The only hint that martial law is available to a president in the Constitution is the part where habeas corpus is supposed to be, it's an equitable remedy at common law, that if somebody's been imprisoned by government or actually even by private people, that somebody can go to the court And that person that being held can be brought to the court to determine whether or not that detention is legal. That then you're entitled to that no matter what, right? And so if the president declares a national state of emergency due to rebellions or the like, then he can suspend or she can suspend habeas corpus. That is one aspect of martial law. In 2007, we tried to expand on the Insurrection Act that got passed in the early 19th century, and it would have allowed for the president to basically take over all of the National Guard and do what was needed to suppress the rebellion or whatever. It passed in 2007. Patrick Leahy and a number of people, including some Republicans, quickly had it overturned in 2008. It passed kind of quietly, but Bush wanted to have that power because of a number of things that were happening. I don't want to get too far into the weeds with that, but basically it got overturned. So we're back to the Insurrection Act, I think, of 1807, something like that. So but that's the closest. But we have had martial law in this country, not recently, but as late as the 1950s. So we want to talk about whether or not what happened in Korea, if something like that happened here, what would be the fallout of it? Dave, what do you want to go a little bit into what happened in South Korea, and then we can bring it back to the question of martial law here in this country?
Yeah, that sounds great to me, because some of the commentators have already mentioned parallels that this event was traumatic for South Korea, but that United States could face something similar in the coming administration based on political rhetoric. So that I think it's a worthwhile comparison just to take advantage of the moment, so to speak. So you had mentioned President Yoon Suk-yeol and how, he was in a sort of a precarious paralysis in his political situation. He won in a very close election. I think it was like 0.8% of the vote. And he was kind of locked in a political fight to get anything done at all. The trade unions are powerful there, so he couldn't really, his competitiveness efforts were being stalled. The media was very much in alignment. Obviously there's mixed media, but from his perspective, he felt that there was a lot of criticism about his administration. His wife was involved in economic scandals. And that's one of the biggest weaknesses of his administration, that there was potentially going to be charges of corruption and other various financial related crimes.
Perhaps much more likely now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so there's a tradition in South Korea where the sort of conservative government that is aligned with the United States, basically, the industrial, I think they're called kaibals there in South Korea, almost like the Japanese kiratsu, which is like the industrial conglomerates, right? So they've got a lot of power. It was a situation where he when he did declare martial law, he said he was going to crack down on the striking workers and dissent and the media. He was basically trying to, get conservatives in alignment against his critics. So that's a parallel with the United States. People there in South Korea, we're not going to get into the history too much, but they have a traumatic historic experience of martial law being declared in a 1980 coup after the assassination of one of their leaders who had been a dictator, effectively a dictator for about 19 years. The book about that, about the massacres that occurred on that during that coup, was basically banned for a long time, and then kind of resurfaced recently in this year, and was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in the award this year, and the award was about to be delivered in a week. So it's just the timing of this thing in South Korea was enough to mobilize folks. You had asked about the process, once he made the speech. saying there was martial law. There were some generals that were in favor of it, but for the most part, the majority of military younger people, that they weren't sympathetic. And so
just to be clear, the leader of his own party denounced it.
Yeah. And I think they realized very quickly, the main opposition leader. And so he said, his name is Li Jiaomeng. He said the declaration of martial law lacks the necessary procedural requirement and was void from the outset. And what he meant by that was they're supposed to get like 2/3 of the parliament to agree. And he just declared it unilaterally. And so parliament returned. There were police. There were some police and some military blocking them from going back to the seat of power at the parliament. But they like broke through windows and they did everything they could to reconvene. And people took to the streets. So basically, there was such a quick pushback, and it was such a clear, unanimous pushback. The vote in parliament, I think, was like 190 to nothing. So everybody that made it back inside voted to overrule. They basically declare that martial law was not valid. So I think that's, you know, that's pretty much as much as we need to know. There's a lot of history here, which is relevant to the conversation, but not relevant to us.
And to be clear, he was accusing members of the assembly, the parliament, of being in league with North Korea. And he was calling them communists. Of course, the main opposition is socialist or social democratic. But but what he intended to do was he intending to arrest them, the people there, or was it just all a pretext just to take the control and maybe disassemble the assembly and then have the other elections that he would hope to win? We don't know. We don't know what his game plan was. It doesn't sound like it was very well thought out. But
I think not being well thought out is a separate issue. But one of the things to what you alluded to, you know, why did this happen this way? Why was he trying to project that anybody who was against him was pro North Korea? It's because he recently was involved in an alliance between Japan, the United States, South Korea. And that was the first time, you know, ever that that South Korea agreed to have a military alliance with Japan. And it's also the first time that Japan has ever agreed to have an offensive military capacity. So basically his position is, hey, if you're against us having an alliance with Japan against China, North Korea, then you must be in favor of North Korea. But right. That's a hot button political issue. That's like, you know, calling someone a communist, like you said, you know, in America. Right. It's a slur, basically. But I think it's interesting. He tapped into this element. There was a quote here: all political activities, including those related to the National Assembly, regional assemblies, political parties, the forming of political organizations, rallies and protests are banned. The act of denying free democracy or attempting a subversion is banned. Fake news, manipulating public opinion, and false instigation is banned.
Finally, that all sounds familiar.
Exactly. The final end: those who violate martial law can be arrested or raided without warrant. So you'd mentioned habeas corpus. In effect, if you've got no warrant, you could just round people up. That's like a violation of the U.S. habeas corpus. It's different, but it's basically subverting a basic political social value to say that the military is in charge and people don't have a voice.
So bringing it back to America, I mean, there are concerns. Those of us, you know, we don't know if it's going to happen. I'm not thinking it's definitely going to happen. But and maybe these events in South Korea would deter it. I don't know. But Donald Trump is going to install some people who believe in the deep state, believe that maybe we already have a kind of a sense of an emergency. And let's say in 2 years that the Republicans lose control of the House or Senate. As of today, it's 215 Democrats and 217 Republicans will be in there. There'll be three more Republicans coming, but they have to be replaced because they've resigned. It's not unlikely, in fact, probably statistically speaking, more likely than not, that he will lose the House, possibly lose the Senate. A lot trickier there, but they've got more structural advantages than Republicans do with regard to the Senate. But the point being is that it could come about that Trump, after 2 years, can't get anything done. And so does he think, as he's losing time, unless he intends to stay in permanently, declare that there's an emergency based on whatever criteria that he and someone like Kash Patel will discuss, and others in his administration or who have his ear. Is this something that could happen? And maybe these events in South Korea are fortuitous, might make them think twice about it. They have a tradition of democracy in South Korea that goes back, 40 years now, a little over 40 years, right, that when it was turned over. We have one that at least in theory goes back 250 years. Tough thing is one thing to get support to do all this when the Republicans in the party, I don't have any faith in that, but when the Republicans in his party stand up to him, if he was able to do that, the people who stood up to him last time he tried something like this were, 7 new senators and 10 House members. But maybe Trump will look at these events and think twice.
So I think theoretically, since both the House and the Senate are, as you mentioned, dominated by Republicans, and the Supreme Court has shown itself to be overtly partisan, that Trump could indeed believe he could declare martial law if he could make the case that it was necessary. And the question is, would he? I think that's a pretty straightforward answer. His former chief of staff, General John Kelly, there's a quote from him that he said he believes Trump has authoritarian tendencies. It's a longer quote, but he basically comes around to saying that, if you look at the definition of fascism, far-right authoritarian, ultra-nationalist political ideology characterized by dictatorial leader, centralized autocracy, militarism, forcible suppression of opposition, and a belief in a national social hierarchy. He's saying, so certainly in my experience, those are the kinds of things that he thinks would work better in terms of running, meaning Trump thinks would work better. And he said, certainly the former president is in the far right area. He's certainly authoritarian. He admires people who are dictators. And then he says, he finishes with, so he certainly falls into the general definition of a fascist for sure. Also, General Mark Milley, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said Trump is a fascist to the core. These are two generals who worked for Donald Trump. They're people from his prior cabinet. And so could it happen? I think that the evidence is that it's certainly within his character to do it if he feels that he can.
If he can get away with it. We need to move on to the next topic. However, real quickly, I looked for any comments by Trump on the South Korean situation. I couldn't find any. I don't have an account at Truth Social, but I didn't see any media reference. Did you?
No, I haven't seen anything yet. Yeah. Coming from
that tells me that tells you something. We'll have to discuss it another time. So this topic is maybe kind of related, hopefully not. We'll find out, assuming he gets appointed. There are some questions about that. But Trump has basically said that he will nominate Kashyap, Kash for short, Patel, who is a former federal prosecutor. He served as the chief of staff to the U.S. Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, and has... And then senior advisor to the acting director of national intelligence, both during Donald Trump's first presidency. He is, by my definitions, an ideologue. We'll talk about it. He's definitely a conservative. He's got deep space theories that he wants to add on. He has threatened in the past to arrest members of the press. Is this all tough talk, or is this something that we need to be concerned with? It's other than the choices for Secretary of Defense and Attorney General Matt Gaetz, which has already been recalled. This is probably the most controversial among a lot of controversial choices. But this But he is, he published the book Government Gangsters, The Deep State, The Truth, and the Battle for Our Democracy, in which Trump praised as a roadmap to end the deep state's reign. So he's going to go in to the FBI. He is going to replace Wray, a current member, who was, by the way, a Trump appointee. Just to be clear, there has never been in its entirety of his existence an FBI head that was a Democrat. Never, not once. They've either been Republicans. I think one of them was an independent. But at any rate, this is somebody who, according to Media Matters, he's shared an image of a flaming Q on it, the QAnon thing. So he will be empowered to, I mean, do God knows what. I'm going to let you tell me, what do you know about Kash Patel?
I think that, there's a lot out there. The airwaves are flooded with his background. I think one of the key things to mention is he got on Donald Trump's radar when he was a former aide to Representative Devin Nunes. And his claim to fame is that he was the author of the memo that claimed that the Department of Justice and the FBI abused their surveillance powers for political reasons to take down Trump. And, if you look at it from a neutral perspective, there were some elements of that memo that have panned out to be true. The Inspector General's office did acknowledge some of those statements to be true and did reject other elements of it. So it's a mixed bag in terms of, if there was some kind of smoking gun about, an abuse or of power to try to weed out some connection between Donald Trump and Putin's Russia's intelligence community. I think, it's not up to me to adjudicate this. Everyone's got their own opinion, but a lot of folks think that, that in effect, we saw that there was communication and meetings and conversations, but that they weren't acting on behalf or in collusion with. So from the right, it's calling it the Russia collusion hoax. And from the left, it's like, look, it's obvious. You look at your staffing, look at your meetings, look at, look at the efforts that were undertaken by Russian intelligence. So I think in the Venn diagram of life, like this, there are some elements of truth. But the point is that got him traction with Donald Trump. People have likened him to a combination of J. Edgar Hoover and Alex Jones, because he's all about all those, like the deep state philosophy that you described. He flat out said that on day one, he wants to close the J. Edgar Hoover building in D.C. and turn it into the Museum of the Deep State. Take those 7,000 federal FBI workers and put them into the field to perform policing duty. I think that's a tongue-in-cheek sort of threat. I don't think they're actually that's a reasonable thing to do. But I think he's making the point that they're drawing a line in the sand about what they consider some a set of conspirators. But he's not just talking about federal law enforcement. He was on Steve Bannon's show saying that conspirators that they're going to, air quotes, go after includes not just government officials, but the media. So his quote was, "We're coming after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections." He also said, "We're putting you on notice. This is why they hate us. This is why we are tyrannical. This is why we are dictators." This is a quote. "We're going to use the Constitution to prosecute them for crimes they said we have always been guilty of, but never have." So he's out there as like the attack dog of Trump to say, like, all the enemies out there, we're going to have a lane to push back from inside the levers of power.
Yeah, I want to go to the interview where he said that, because this was appearing about a year ago on Steve Bannon's War Room podcast. And Patel agreed that Donald Trump is dead serious about his intent to seek revenge against political enemies if he got elected. And he has been elected. And this is the full quote. "We will go out and find the conspirators, not just in government, but in the media. We're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you. whether it's criminally or civilly, we'll figure that out. But yeah, we're putting you all on notice. And Steve, this is why they hate us. This is why we're tyrannical. This is why we're dictators, because we're going to use the Constitution to prosecute them for crimes they said have always been guilty of, but never have. Now, this is a fascinating thing, because the conservatism is breeding a new type of person. The whole point of the Constitution is to limit the power of government. Government doesn't use the Constitution for anything. It's supposed to, it's what guides and limits the power, the whole concept of it. That's why we don't have certain provisions in our Constitution, like such as the Netherlands and other countries, that mandate that the government be empowered to make a environmental, deal with the environment. The closest thing we come to it are the list of powers that are given to Congress. And of course, the conservatives argue that Congress can only do those list of powers. It's not, whereas others say, no, it's mandatory. It's not, and so the conservative view is that you look at the Constitution in terms of its strictest sense against government power. That's in theory. But historically, you've had conservatives, even as recently as the overturning of Roe v. Wade in Dobbs, that, well, we don't have a right to privacy. It's not in the Constitution, so we don't have a right to privacy, right? And the Ninth Amendment is just something that's redundant with the Tenth Amendment. So, no, there's not any other rights out there. It's what's listed, and that's that. I mean, ironically, Madison said that's why he didn't want to have a Bill of Rights initially, because morons would make that argument, that it would limit that, and there's no way we could possibly list all the rights that people are entitled to. But, it was intended to be a guide. Anyway, I'm not going to get too far into that. But the point is that Donald Trump is bringing into government people who have a much more authoritarian view of the Constitution. The very idea that the Constitution can be a weapon by government against private individuals is just mind-boggling. It sets out when it can happen. But they've got a different view of it. They've got a view of it as some type of religious text almost. So is this tough talk? Is this one of those things that people who voted for Trump, said, oh, they're just exaggerating what they're going to do when they get into office? They'll moderate. Well, that's what all the conservative parties thought. And I know this is going to sound melodramatic, but that's what all the conservative parties thought when they voted for the Enabling Act in 1933, giving Hitler near total power. They thought, well, he's going to have be too busy governing the country to be able to, to be so ideological. And, well, famous last words, it didn't work out that way. People say, well, you're comparing Trump to Hitler and there's no way he's as bad as Hitler. It's not a question of who's bad or who's worse. It's a question of anybody in a position of absolute power. The old quote, I forget who quoted it, absolute power corrupts absolutely. The point is that it doesn't matter how good a person you are. If you've got total power, you're going to misuse it. And if you've got a sort of a sense of, your own self-importance and everything wrapped around you, that is a bad possible combination. There are a lot of differences between Trump and Hitler. I'm not making the comparison between Trump and Hitler. I'm making the comparison between the potential for the end of democracy, because so many people in this country just think it's all about getting the right person in charge and not limiting that power.
I think there's a couple interesting elements about his proposal, having him put forth as a nominee. If you look back during the Trump administration, near the end, Trump was trying to promote Kash Patel into various positions. So when he tried to put him into the FBI, Bill Barr, Attorney General, or into the Justice Department. Bill Barr, the Attorney General at the time, was Republican, said that he was unqualified and too detached from reality. and that he, you know, he would let Trump appoint him only over his dead body. And Gina Haspel, the CIA director, they were talking about putting him in as like a deputy director, and she threatened to resign. And she ended up getting help from Vice President Pence and White House Counsel Pat Cipollone to help block the appointment as deputy director within the CIA. Other people, you know, have said similar criticisms from conservative circles from the right. And in part, let's talk about why people make that only half joke that he's a cross between J. Edgar Hoover and Alex Jones, is because he really does court all the conspiracy, you know, narratives out there, including the most extreme conspiracy narrative, the QAnon movement. So David Cornyn, Mother Jones, you could look into it yourself and see he documents pretty clearly that Kash Patel has, you know, flirted with the QAnon community for a while now, including when he hand signs his book, he puts in, he claimed that he put in WWG1WGA, where we go one, we go all. That's a QAnon mantra. And whenever he's asked about it, he kind of, you know, sloughs it off a little bit. And he basically says, this is a quote, people keep asking me about all this Q stuff. And I'm like, what does it matter? What I'm telling you is there is truth in a lot of things that many people say. And what I'm putting out there is the truth. And how about we have some fun along the way? Let's have some fun with the truth. So he's revealing that he knows that it's really about the people. It's about the power. It's about playing Trump's base, not playing, but you know, aligning yourself with Trump's base in a way that ties together the far right conspiracism, the deep state conspiracism. And so David Cornyn, as a takeaway, he said in the article, I said, Patel's relationship with QAnon shows either that he has a severely distorted view of reality or that he will recklessly exploit dangerous, misguided, and false ideas for political benefit. Neither is an approach suitable for the most powerful and important law enforcement agency in the land. So I think that's an important perspective on the potential next director of the FBI.
Again, we're in this position of, well, don't believe what they say. They're going to be different when they were in office. That didn't, I'm referring to the lessons of Germany 1933, but let's just refer to Trump in 2016 to 2020. He didn't moderate. He didn't moderate on anything. He almost moderated on immigration reform, but the minute he did, his handlers basically turned it into a meeting where there was no discussion. Trump just basically said he promised to meet with Democrats to come up with some compromises to provide assurance of renewing the DACA program, but unfortunately, anti-immigrant ideology is one of the strongest in the MAGA movement. That is like that's the soul of their movement. That's when his first big speeches, when he first declared in 2015 the Black Snake speech. It is something that he has progressed on in this most recent one. They're eating the cats. They're eating the dogs. I mean, it is just that it's too powerful. So everybody thought, well, maybe we'll get some, you know, he's a maverick. Maybe he'll buck his own party. He did for not even 24 hours. When the Democrats showed up to negotiate with him, it had been completely shut down. Everything he'd said that they were going to talk about was off the table. And there were advisors in there to cut things off if anything went any way they didn't like. So that was the closest he came to moderating in any way. And it failed. He didn't. He didn't even have control. You know, I don't know. Will the billionaires that are supporting them, you know, Elon and Bezos, you know, maybe moderate them somewhat on social issues? I don't know, but the fact that he's putting this guy in, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of Republican resistance to it right now. Maybe that'll come up later as more stuff comes out. But, you know, the problem is he hasn't been in a position of power to abuse yet, right? So we don't know. It's just he's only just promised to abuse it. They're saying rhetoric. So it becomes a big question. Is Does this mean that Trump truly intends to weaponize the FBI and possibly the DOJ and others basically go after political enemies for revenge?
That's a good segue for the next segment, actually.
Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause. The cause of democracy.
We are going to raise issues that, you know, historically have not been raised.
What about the nuclear option, doing away with the filibuster? I can tell you that would be the end of the Senate as it was originally devised.
All of this is possible for America. Who was standing in the way? Mitch McConnell.
Where an insurrection that sought to overturn an election, when that failed, the action moved into state capitals.
Which brings us to our final topic, and that is the President Biden going back on his promise, if it was a promise, to not pardon his son, Hunter Biden. This, of course, is causing problems for the Democrats. Republicans are going all crazy about it. Because he had said in an interview before that, no, I have no intention of pardoning him. And, because of the optics of it. Patel was, the announcement came, at least it reached the media on this last Sunday. I think it was like 3 hours later that Biden announced that it was already in the process of pardoning him. I think there's a causal relationship there. Because it's one thing to be political and say, you know what, we're not going to be nepotistic or show, you know, favor in here. But he is my son, and I am not going to leave him at the mercy of the crazy people that are coming in, especially not Kash Patel. So he's basically pardoned him for everything that's happened up until this point, whether he did it or not. So unless Hunter does something new, Patel is in theory powerless to do anything about it. But I wish is that Biden had never made the promise. Just say, you know what, my pardoning decisions will be based on my judgment at the time, blah, blah, blah. I wish he had made that promise because, yeah, it doesn't look good, especially to people who don't understand why. I wish now that he's done it, he would say, no, yeah, I intended to stay out of it, but then I don't think there's going to be rule of law, or there's a danger that the next administration is not going to be run by rule of law. And I don't want to give them any ability to basically use my son as a hostage. You know, I mean, he should have just be open and said that. Maybe he will by the time it's done. But it's hard, just based on the timing, to imagine that decision was not at least a factor, if not the primary direct result of the announcement of the intended nomination of Kash Patel. People keep saying calling it these things nominations, by the way, but technically a president can't actually nominate until he's in office. Right now, he's still a private citizen. So he's stating his intention to nominate Kash Patel. And I'm a father. Under similar circumstances, if one of my children was in that situation and I had the power to do something about it, I would do it. Does it look good? No. But Dave, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So thank you for that setup as always. I think that there's a couple, like Petrushka dolls or whatever they're called. There's a couple layers to this, yeah. or you could say like an onion, right? So on the surface, I agree with you that it's absolutely the case that Joe Biden has made it clear in his statement. He said the charges in this case came about only after several of my political opponents in Congress instigated them to attack me and oppose my election. So we see that the president is framing it this way. He also said no reasonable person who looks at the facts of Hunter's cases can reach any other conclusion than Hunter was singled out because he's my son, and that is wrong. And finally, the president said, I believe in the justice system, but as I have wrestled with this, I also believe raw politics has infected this process and it led to a miscarriage of justice.
Okay, so, I had missed that. So that yep. That's kind of it without pointing direct, without naming specific people.
Yeah. So that, I think that's the kind of the high level. And under that prism, or, you know, through that prism, rather, you could see how, hey, look, if this is your son and you see this as an attack on you, as a political attack, then you can equally fight back, fight fire with fire, and politicize the pardon. Pardons are almost by definition political. Or worse, right? Like we've seen, like I think Bill Clinton pardoned, you know, hundreds of people in the last few hours. Many right. presidents do. It's about, you know, it's kind of ugly reality of pardons. But in this instance, more to the point, there's a couple other layers here. So one is that the Democrats appear, the party itself, the president, his administration appear hypocritical. By staking so much of their claim on the values and no one being above the law, and right. and saying over and over again for you know, anytime they're asked that there's no pardon, so that's more of a values criticism, and I think that you know, if the shoe fits, then so be it. Like they deserve it. He deserves it. It is hypocritical to say we're not going to politicize something and then make it political. If you're looking at it that way, through the lens of hypocrisy. But I actually want to bounce to you something that I think is underreported, intentionally probably, but the fact that you'd mentioned if there were any other crimes. From the perspective of the right, of Trump and Kash Patel, there are a lot of other crimes. And from the House of Representatives, their investigations, their perspective is that there are other crimes right there ready to be charged. And we don't have to get into the specifics of them, but basically not registering as a foreign agent under FARA, Foreign Right. Agent Registration Act, representing a Ukrainian energy company, representing a Romanian oligarch, representing Chinese energy companies with, you know, massive global implications on that last one. I'm sure it's not going to be something that people talk about very much, but if there was a witch hunt that was initiated, they would probably find more crimes, is I think the big takeaway.
I think that they're probably scouring it. The department hasn't officially happened yet. I don't think it's going to happen, and it'll probably incorporate every possibility. They'll probably scan through me. You know, if they miss something, obviously the Republicans will do it. But I assume that Biden is going to go across the board and pardon him for everything.
I'll mention this now because you called it. Obviously, your lawyer brain was working. I think that's going to be the criticism. Maybe people will pick up on the breadcrumbs, but the details of the pardon is that it clears. It's a blanket pardon, and it's for anything that he did, might have done, or might have. What's the exact word? It's a full and unconditional pardon, a blanket pardon for crimes he committed or may have committed or may have taken part in during the period January 2014 through December 2024. So it's the entirety of the time that he was, post.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And that's unusual because most presidential pardons, I've seen the analysis, mostly they're going to name specific crimes, specific charges, case numbers, sentences. This is closest to Nixon's, Ford pardoning Nixon for the entire duration of the term. This right. was done to move the country forward. And you could say, you know, from a historic perspective, if Joe Biden really wanted to move the country forward on this whole episode, this blanket pardon was the way to do it.
Yeah, I don't believe that there wasn't a deal between Ford and Nixon, but I don't want to get off on that. Like I said, there have been in the past prosecutors that try to get around saying, well, he couldn't be pardoned for something that he didn't actually do, so we can still charge him for that. Which made absolutely no sense, because how can you charge him for something he didn't do, right? I mean, it's we can investigate whether he did it and they're asking if they want to do that. But that's going to be a complete waste of time. Quite frankly, I don't think the voters were all that motivated by Hunter Biden, either in 2020 or in 2024. I don't think he was a major factor. And I noticed that even after the conviction came in the one trial, Trump didn't have a whole lot to say about it. In fact, Trump, in an interview, did not exclude the possibility of pardoning Hunter Biden. I don't know if this is the first time a relative has been pardoned. I can't say that, but it certainly will give Trump permission to pardon his whole family. I was surprised he didn't do it the first time, actually. But I think at that point he probably hoped he could be elected again, and that would have raised a lot of questions of, well, are they guilty of something, right? You know, so it's just the politics of pardons are really complicated. There's a lot of pressure on people lobby for pardons, and it's very interesting how many get them. And they are disproportionately white collar crimes. Going all the way back. And there's a question as to whether or not a president should even have that power. But it's supposed to be, it's the last possible chance in case there's been injustice in the system. But I trust the system more than I trust the impulses of a president who's, got a few hours left in office. But there'll be a list of them, a long list. Trump had a whole bunch of them, including, a rapper and, a few other people on that. I imagine he may break tradition and start doing, he's promised to pardon a whole bunch of the January 6th convicts. People have asked me, and we've talked about in the show, well, can he pardon himself? In theory, there's no reason he can't, but he cannot pardon himself of the charges under which he's been convicted, because those are states. He doesn't have any jurisdiction over state convictions. It was based on state law, and it was a state court. That's why he tried to get it transferred to federal court, so that possibly he could do that and also possibly get it to judges that he had appointed, even all the way up to the Supreme Court. Although the Supreme Court has jurisdiction everywhere, basically, so they could probably take it up. But this is where we're at. I expect there's going to be that Trump is going to do hundreds of pardoning across the board early on, and this is going to look like pretty small change.
Two things. One is, I'm going to agree with you in the sense that you could imagine that, Trump and his allies have claimed that the deep state and the Democratic Party, or some, combination of the two, have been engaged in what they call lawfare. So that's like warfare using the legal system. So it's pretty much, standard boilerplate social criticism coming from Trump's allies and him, that the levers of power were used against him in a political way that's not consistent with what ought to be. So you can justify a wave of pardons under that scenario. So that's one element I think is worth, I'm agreeing with you on. I mean, I think at a high level, we know that corruption happens. We know that people are, self-interested economic actors and trying to get advantageous economic relationships, whether they're in or out of elected office. When it gets to that next level, when foreign countries start to get involved, we know that people get prosecuted for these things. What Hunter was prosecuted for was basically saying, I want to buy this gun and I'm going to check the box that says I'm right. Not on drugs. So yeah. that's one of those crimes where I could just think, most Americans, most people I have known or talked to, that's not where they think that our federal law enforcement efforts ought to be going towards, especially if Hunter were to say, well, I'm not on drugs right now, but I did this morning and I'm going to be tomorrow. Right. So it just doesn't seem like that's a particularly appropriate use of taxpayer resources. About not paying taxes, I think that opens up a can of worms. People have said, oh, well, he has, paid taxes with penalties and interest, and there's, that's a done deal. That's open and shut. But in reality, what are we talking about? We're talking about streams of income from his, we'll call them consulting gigs. And some of those consulting gigs were involving foreign countries, foreign actors, foreign companies. And you know, Trump's lawyer, Paul Manafort, he went to jail for not being a registered, foreign agent. But Hunter Biden was not a registered foreign agent. So you know, I think the evidence is out there. It's not up to us to adjudicate this today, of course. No. But it sounds like it's, you know, selective prosecution for political reasons. So
it's definitely selective prosecution. The point is that, you know, Biden, the biggest mistake he made is to say he wasn't going to do it. He had no intention, and he probably said that for the purpose of the election, but he shouldn't have said it because nobody, I think you could probably, any of the voters who were going to have real strong opinions about Hunter Biden were not going to vote Democratic anyway. You know, most people don't, you know, care. I mean, there's the whole thing about how the story supposedly got buried back in 2020. I don't remember. Now, maybe it's just my media, frequent, but I thought it was discussed ad nauseum. But that's, you know, just as a matter of fact. I mean, maybe not at MSNBC by people like Rachel Maddow or whatever. Maybe they didn't discuss it. I don't know. But I certainly had no shortage of information about it. And then there was the FBI had given a warning that there was going to be some massive misinformation coming from Russia. And it just so happened that the Hunter Biden story broke and everybody thought that's what the misinformation was. And, you know, was it or wasn't it? Or was that what was actually happening? Who knows? But that was, you know, evidence that somehow Ray, a Trump appointee all the way back to 2017, was an operative of the Democrats, lifelong Republican, right? I mean, it goes without saying. But there were those emails of the people making the comments of, you know, in the FBI as to what their thoughts were about Trump, kind of a lot like the DNC emails about Bernie, although nobody ever took the action that they talked about. They didn't use his agnosticism against him. But I'm going to let you close this.
Yeah, I would just say real briefly, we are out of time, so we got to wrap it up this segment. But there was, just to complement one of the things that you say, there was that letter that was released, signed by, I think it was a dozen or more former intelligence officers that said that this whole Hunter Biden thing was part of a Russian disinformation. It was like a Russian disinformation campaign. And so that was introduced into the media ecosystem. And I think it all, you know, again, where you stand depends on where you sit.
Yeah.
This brings us to our predictions. Dave, what do you have for us?
Okay. It's been widely reported Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense, Fox News contributor Pete Hegseth, had to settle a 2017 sexual assault allegation. The fallout from that incident has now been compounded by recent reporting that he was forced out of leadership roles at two veterans advocacy organizations due to misconduct after misusing funds, sexually harassing women, being repeatedly drunk on the job, all these alleged misconduct actions. A leaked email from his own mother asked him to take an honest look at himself and get help on behalf of all the women that she said that he abused in the past. Well, it appears that these revelations are likely to be too problematic for him to survive Senate confirmation as the next Secretary of Defense. Multiple sources have confirmed that conversations are underway with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to replace Hegseth as the nominee to be the head of the Department of Defense. And that person, one of the people on his staff, even said DeSantis is a leader in anti-woke policy that Trump wants replicated in the Pentagon. And he believes the governor can help root out waste in the department. And here's a quote. He needs, don't give an F, honey badger to go in there and root out waste And the governor is the OG honey badger. So, but this is where it gets interesting. At this point, Trump's transition team is looking to have Lara Trump replace Marco Rubio as the U.S. Senator from Florida. So DeSantis is supposedly not keen on this appointment, but the Bulwark quotes one source familiar with the discussion as saying, who knows what's going to happen? This is Trump's world. We're all just living in it. My prediction is that we will indeed see Trump successfully leverage the appointment of Governor DeSantis as the next Secretary of Defense to ensure his daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, gets the Senate appointment from the state of Florida.
Okay. Well, did you remember when Trump was calling them de sanctimonious? Bygones, bygones. So real quickly, Mitch McConnell is really upset, angry that two Democratic appointed judges are canceling their retirement plans, which would deprive Trump of possibly of the opportunity of replacing them unless they die or retire sometime in the future. One is Max Coburn, who did it shortly after Algernon. I can't ever read the second name. But anyway, two judges are doing it. My prediction, as I've looked at it, is two to four additional judges are going to cancel their retirements. But for Mitch McConnell to scream about this, the fact of the matter is there were three conservative judges who did exactly the same thing in anticipation of Biden having won. And it's not the first time it's happened. It's not anything that's there. He's just angry because we can do it and they can't do it. So my prediction is there's going to be two to four more doing this, maybe a little more than usual, but that's because they don't believe that there's going to be rule of law. Well, we'll find out if any of this comes true. Until next time, stay informed and stay engaged. It's a little bit.